Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Over 4 million American students took advanced placement or AP exams in 2014. Nothing much out of the ordinary there. But when we look closely at the numbers in published reports, we find that fewer than 5% of those exams were given to test proficiency in German, Italian, Japanese, Spanish, or other foreign languages. Correspondingly, the Modern Language Association has found the number of college students taking language classes dropped by about 100,000 from 2009 to 2013. So, many fewer students are tackling foreign language courses, even as they prepare to enter a workforce that's increasingly competing in a global economy. We're going to get an update on language requirements at the primary, secondary, and collegiate levels. What's being offered? Have there been significant cutbacks? And if so, why? Also, later this hour, learning a second language can benefit the brain, no matter what your age. And then, the world is home to thousands of languages, many of which are moving toward extinction. So, lots to talk about this hour. And as always, here's the number if you'd like to join us in conversation. 888-477-9499. Email radiotimes at whyy.org, or you can tweet us at whyyradiotimes. So will the next generation be at least somewhat proficient in languages other than English? Rosemary Fayal is Executive Director of the Modern Language Association of America. Welcome to Radio Times, Rosemary.
Thanks, Mary. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what do you think of the numbers? The drop of tens of thousands of college students who are taking foreign languages, the relatively small number of AP exams being given, gauging a proficiency in foreign language. How do you read this, Rosemary?
I read it as a complex situation in the United States where about 20% of us speak a language other than English at home, but fewer and fewer of us are studying languages formally in primary and secondary grades and colleges and universities. Two quick factors might account for the shifts that we're seeing. One, the Common Core state standards have crowded out a lot of what are, in the United States curriculums, electives, like studying languages other than English. And at the college level, we are seeing a drop in requirements for languages, along with majors that often give students very little flexibility in electives. So those are two of the factors I might start out with.
Yeah. Well, on the college level, Roberto Ferdman writes in the Washington Post that there might be a connection there with the drop coming out of the Great Recession, and that it's not a coincidence that business management is the most popular subject major across the country. What's your take there?
Absolutely. New majors such as business, which maybe 20, 30 years ago you didn't study in a liberal arts curriculum, and other majors that are considered highly marketable have become the norm. Nevertheless, what we're hearing from people in business is that language skills and communication skills and understanding of the world outside the boundaries of the United States are key to success in business and in other occupations. So that strikes us at the Modern Language Association as a call for greater language proficiency.
Which languages are seeing the biggest losses?
Right now we're seeing, in the latest study, which we're completing right now, we're seeing stability in languages. So that drop that you mentioned, which was about 6.7% of enrollments in our last study, right now we're seeing a stability in enrollments, and that's a good thing. The ones that are dropping are the traditional European languages, so German, French, Italian. Spanish holds steady, obviously, because of the interest of so many heritage speakers.
Sure.
But we're seeing Russian increasing, and of course Asian languages have been increasing in enrollment since the start of the 21st century.
Well, and actually that led to the next question. You know, what people are studying if they do take up a foreign language, you know, should the focus be perhaps away more from European languages and more toward some of the less traditional languages, say Mandarin or Russian, or even I was reading, 193 million people across the world speak Bengali.
Exactly. So what you're saying makes perfect sense. We should, as a country, be focusing on many languages, and students should have those opportunities early on. And there's some good news there. There are many dual language programs and language immersion programs in K through 12, and they're not just in Spanish where you might expect them. They're in Arabic and Vietnamese and Chinese. And we're seeing them not just in the large school districts, such as here in New York where I live, and California, but also in Rhode Island, and Utah has a public statewide effort in this regard. And what we're seeing when you give kids dual immersion early on, not only do they learn the language quickly and well, but if they are in a group with English language learners, let's say you're in a community where there's lots of kids whose native language is Vietnamese, and you do a Vietnamese dual immersion program, the English speakers not only learn Vietnamese, they learn other things such as empathy, knowledge of cultures other than their own. So the benefits are much greater than language fluency.
How are these dual immersion programs meshing with Common Core standards? So we're seeing an increasing acceptance of these programs despite perhaps the limitations of Common Core?
I think you can do both. Obviously, you can study your Common Core subjects in languages other than English, except for the language arts part. But what we're seeing is a deliberate effort on communities' parts when they get these programs going. It takes funding. It takes community willpower. So, in the city where I live in New York, the public school chancellor has committed to creating, I think it's 40 expanded or dual language programs and secured $1 million in federal funding. So you really have to have local initiative and parent support.
Well, and yes, and New York is obviously a vast multicultural community. So are we seeing this increased interest in dual immersion programs in other parts of the country, Rosemary?
Absolutely. Some great examples are in South Dakota, Texas, Virginia, Illinois. So certainly a state like South Dakota is not going to have the same multilingual and multicultural profile as a city like New York or Philadelphia.
Yeah. So despite the fact that, you know, with tight budgets, you know, in the primary and secondary school levels, you know, where sports and art and language courses are often targeted, you are seeing a little bit of light here in the story in these dual immersion programs.
Yes, and also in the recognition on the part of many college students that languages are an essential component for their future success. Mm. Just, even though you're seeing a shift of fewer enrollments, we're also seeing the advanced courses getting a higher percentage of students. That is, students going beyond the first two semesters of a language course. That is the key to advanced fluency. It's not the number of enrollments that we're seeing, but rather how fluent are these students? How much time are they spending outside the United States in study abroad and practicing the language? Are they doing internships in the languages? So at the Modern Language Association, we've been helping departments at colleges and universities create opportunities in their curriculum so the students can use those languages and make sense of what they're studying in the context of a larger world.
Rosemary Farrell, let's get to what's happening at Princeton University, which is getting some attention with a new proposal that all undergrads at Princeton must study a foreign language, even if students are already coming in proficient in a second language. A Princeton task force says, "We see language as a critical point of entry into cross-cultural understanding." So say learning French is more than being able to make your way around Paris.
Absolutely. Listen, in Europe, every single student at the college level is studying and has studied 2 to 3 languages other than their native language. It's the norm. So in that sense, the example Princeton is showing is that they are doing what advanced countries do with regard to languages. I mean, just look at the education that Donald Trump's son, Barron, has had. He is perfectly bilingual in English and Slovenian and has acquired French. And this is all at a pre-college level. Our future First Lady in a few days speaks five languages fluently. Mm. That's how the world is. The world is multilingual. The United States has had many historic reasons for not cultivating its plurilingualism. But as I started out when we began the conversation, 20% of us, including me, speak a language other than English at home, and about 43% of us didn't. We were born in the United States. So bilingualism is woven into the fabric of the United States. We just have to recognize its value and cultivate it.
Well, there can also be pressure on college, of course, to complete other course requirements. And there's also a perception, you know, well, English is still the common language of international business. Why shouldn't I focus my attention on technology or other course offerings? How do you answer that, Rosemary?
I answer it in the way that any of us who are bilingual answer it. If you do go to a country and depend on your English to understand all the transactions, conversations, cultural nuances, you will miss a great deal, and it will be detrimental to your business relations.
All right, let's get to
the business leaders tell us that.
Okay, and so we do have, let's go, at least one call in before the break. Rick in Warminster is standing by. Hi, Rick. Welcome to Radio Times.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a very fascinating topic. I just wanted to say I see the value of the languages. In my own experience, I had taken Latin in high school, and that built a foundation so that I could then take French. I continued that into college. And then that helped me become an advisor in Vietnam because they spoke French and Vietnamese. And then that led me, when I got out of the military, to a job with the Olympics because the language of the Olympics is French. Hmm. And that led me to overseas work in the corporate world because the United Nations, the official language is French.
Yeah.
So it can expand your communications, which is my degree in mass communications, and into the media just by having etymology and an appreciation for the other cultures.
Rick, thanks so much for the call to Radio Times. And Rosemary, I assume we're preaching to the choir here.
We are preaching to the choir, but notice how Rick's major was mass communications and how language is, although intricate to what he does, it's also auxiliary. So that's the point. And once you learn one language, it's easier and easier to learn more languages. So Rick, yes, is a poster child for why we want language opportunities early and often, and how they do enhance not just a career but a life. That sounded like a very fascinating life trajectory.
Rosemary, we only have about 30 seconds left, but your association wants to see new options for what you call heritage learners. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. The United States is often seen as a language cemetery where the world's languages come to die. The Modern Language Association wants our country to value the languages that come here, to encourage speakers to achieve advanced fluency in the heritage languages, and to teach English speakers of those languages. So we want to see that great resource tapped.
Thanks so much for joining us, Rosemary Fayal, Executive Director of the Modern Language Association of America. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mary. My pleasure.
And just ahead, the neurological benefits of being a bilingual or multilingual speaker. Stay with us. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Suffice it to say, it can be challenging to learn a new language, but aside from the satisfaction of being able to converse in, say, French or Mandarin, there's also a documented neurological benefit. And joining us now to shed some light is Ellen Bialystok, Distinguished Research Professor of Psychology and the Walter Gordon York Research Chair of Lifespan Cognitive Development at York University. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
So let's get down to the nuts and bolts of the brain process in layman's terms. When we listen to someone speak in any language, what is the brain doing in trying to interpret what's being said, and how might being bilingual help that process?
Well, the key to why bilingualism changes the way the brain works comes down to a very simple well-documented but completely counterintuitive fact, and that is, if you're bilingual, then both of your languages are always active. They're both always involved in what you're trying to say, even if you're in a completely monolingual context, even if you know that nobody you're speaking to has the slightest idea about the other language, even though using the other language would completely be a conversation stopper, in your brain, both languages are always active. And we know that bilinguals do a pretty good job of speaking the right language. How do they do that? And the answer is that the bilingual brain uses an attention mechanism, a cognitive mechanism, to make sure that you're using the right language all the time. So there's a whole level of activity that's going on in a bilingual brain that is not involved in a monolingual brain. And it's that ongoing need to pay attention to the right language that's responsible for all of the brain and cognitive effects we've seen of bilingualism.
So is this much more difficult for the brain than when we talk about somebody who's multilingual?
I think the difference between bilingualism and multilingualism in that aspect is not a big one. If you've got to select the language that you need to be speaking, it doesn't seem to make a huge difference if you're selecting between two options or three options. It's the difference between having to select the right language and not having to do that at all, which is the monolingual situation.
All right, we're talking to Ellen Bialystok, who is a distinguished research professor of psychology at York University. And I'd like to give the number out if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So, Ellen, according to The New Yorker, the traditional thinking from researchers regarding children and bilingualism, at least in the early part of the 20th century, was that bilingualism could actually hurt IQ and verbal development. Let's take a brief look back. Why did they think this?
Well, the early ideas about the harmful consequences of bilingualism were rooted in a sociocultural context of fear of immigrants, of concern about ethnicity, shall we say, a time when there was a lot of suspicion around difference. And because it seemed that immigrants to the United States, most of this is based on immigrants to the United States in the early part of the 20th century, were different, didn't learn English very well, seemed not to be very successful, the interpretation was that the culprit was bilingualism. Immigrants were tested when they got to Ellis Island on an intelligence test, and not surprisingly, they did very badly. Why? The test was in English. Nobody stopped to think. Children in schools, children of immigrants, struggled with English curricula before their English was really adequate for these sorts of assessments. So there were a number of factors that led to this belief. Now, once this was out there, then parents did what all parents will always do, and that is want the best for their children. So hearing these stories about harmful effects of bilingualism, parents went to some lengths to make sure their children remain monolingual. You get rid of the heritage language. You avoid contact with these other confusing systems and so on. So that led to a set of beliefs and a set of educational policy decisions that were rooted in the notion that bilingualism was harmful.
Well, fast forward to today, and as we were discussing with Rosemary Fayal just a few minutes ago, dual language programs, immersion programs, are becoming increasingly popular at the elementary school level, subjects taught in two languages. And apparently, Ellen, we're seeing some real positive feedback regarding children who are in these programs in brain development. From your perspective, what are we seeing?
Well, the brain evidence is very clear, and we have brain evidence from across the lifespan. So the idea, again, is very simple. Your brain adapts to what it has to do. Excuse me. And so if you give your brain a problem to solve, like select the language you need to be speaking, the brain will reorganize so that's just part of what it does easily and automatically. And in so doing, it creates a better brain. It creates a brain that's better at paying attention. It's better at monitoring what's going on. It's just a simple response to what you're asking the brain to do. And this is a standard belief in neuroscience. Your brain absolutely responds to and is changed by whatever you want it to do.
Yeah. Well, perhaps go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
There's also evidence, Ellen, that being bilingual can help kids socially, that they're better at communicating, and this probably shouldn't come as a surprise, but what's happening here, and does this also perhaps apply to the child who might be introverted?
I don't know about any research, but it's a very interesting idea. I think that people who have the ability to speak different languages, children who understand different cultures, children who have these experiences, I think would have, as a consequence, different social experiences. And just as cognitive experiences change the way your cognitive system works, I think social experiences would too, but I don't know that research. Mm. I think it's a plausible idea.
Is there much brain benefit to being exposed to a different language at home, but not necessarily learning how to speak it?
Ah, okay. As far as I can tell, because these effects are all based on experience, they're all there what we call experience-dependent plasticity. So these brain effects and cognitive effects come from the experience of using another language. It follows that the more experience you have, the greater the effect. If you want to learn to play piano, you know that if you want to be a better pianist, you have to practice more. And your whole playing technique and capacity will reflect how much practice you put in. I think it's the same principle. So a little bit of exposure, there's a language in the home that you never really speak, but over time begin to understand, has a gradual impact. So I think it's a continuum of experience.
And Ellen Bialystok, let's now go to the other end of the lifespan. Can learning a second language help to ward off dementia?
Well, I think the thinking here is a little bit different. We have lots of evidence that we can postpone symptoms of dementia. You can't prevent dementia, but you can postpone symptoms of dementia, which is to say people can continue to function at a higher level even as dementia pathology takes over their brain, if they have been lifelong bilinguals. So can you jump in at the age of 60 or 70, learn a language, and hope for those effects? There's no good evidence that that works, but there is another kind of argument for it. We know that anything you do that's hard for your brain is good for your brain. So if you engage in difficult, stimulating, effortful activities, all of that contributes to brain health in older age and postpones symptoms of dementia. Learning another language as an older adult is incredibly difficult. So the experience of engaging in an incredibly difficult activity in itself is good for your brain and can potentially help protect against the early symptoms of dementia.
And do we know how much time that buys us in postponing those symptoms?
Well, we know that for lifelong bilinguals, it's up in the order of about 4 years.
Okay.
We know nothing about this more vague experience.
All right. Let's get back to the phones. Charles in West Philly is here now and joining us for Radio Times. Hi, Charles.
Hi, good morning. My question for your guest is, how would she rate current bilingual or ESL or ELL programs that are currently afloat in most urban districts where you have a really robust, diverse speaking population of native speakers of, you know, particularly, let's say, Spanish. It's growing, you know, it's going into some Asian languages as well. But if she has any information on that and what she would recommend.
Oh, thanks, Charles, for the call to Radio Times. Not sure you have that information at your fingertips, Ellen, but you want to take a crack at it?
I couldn't actually hear the question very clearly. It kind of broke up.
He was asking about current strategies in ESL and other programs in urban districts where you have you tend to have lots of different groups from different countries and different languages being spoken. And he was wondering if you had information on how those strategies are doing and working, if I've got that correct.
Yeah, language pedagogy is quite outside my expertise, so I really wouldn't have any comment.
All right. We've got an email from Richard who asks, isn't there research that bilinguals tend not to be as facile and adept in both languages as unilingual users?
Not to be as, repeat that again?
As facile and adept in both languages as unilingual users.
Ah, okay, okay. Well, yes and no. So we have a huge database of research that shows if you take a bilingual and you give them really detailed tests in one of their two languages, like what's their vocabulary size, how fast can they name pictures of common objects in that language, how many items can they generate when you say name all of the animals you can think of, tests like this that are rather precise measures of sort of how much language you know, then on average means not every single person. It means on average, bilinguals will generate fewer words. They will have smaller vocabulary. They'll take a little bit longer to retrieve each word than monolinguals on average. However, none of that accounts for the fact that they can also do this in a completely other language. So overall, they have more vocabulary. And that these differences that we can measure in a laboratory are completely imperceptible in ordinary language use. So it's true that there's some kind of reduction in what we would call native speaker levels of performance in each language, again, on average. But I would argue that these have very little bearing on what we normally think of when we consider how proficient a person is in using a language.
So, Ellen, if somebody were considering tackling a second language, you would say, go for it.
Well, as a friend of mine once said, I'd rather take the 4-year delay of dementia symptoms than the reduced vocabulary.
All right, back to the phones. Almond is calling us from Richmond, Virginia. Hi, Almond.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for an illuminating discussion. I'd like to share a personal experience. I grew up in India and then moved to the United States. And in India, we were almost perfectly, you know, fluent in English and Hindi.
Oh, I think we lost the call. Almond, are you with us?
Hi, can you hear me?
Hello? Oh, yes, we can.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for an illuminating discussion. I'd like to share my personal experience. I grew up in India, and in India, we were almost perfectly fluent and, you know, bilingual between English and Hindi, and I'd say my vocabulary is really good in both. I was also able to learn French for about 10 years, and, you know, that added a third dimension. I personally found it extremely easy to, you know, navigate these different worlds. It helps me converse with people from different cultures, watch movies, and it really challenges me. Recently, I've actually started learning Japanese, you know, trying to pick a language that really wasn't from the same spectrum. Yeah. And I'm finding, again, an ability to, you know, open my horizons. The one thing I don't see, and maybe it's a question, is when will we see a change in the public space, you know, on NPR, in Parliament or in Congress that allows for, you know, true bilingual fluency and, you know, people like in the United Nations.
Yeah, I think that's a whole nother show, Almond. But just a very brief question for you before we let you go.
Sure.
Did you, you went along and you took on these additional languages, did you find it becoming easier for you to conquer different languages the more you learned?
Yes, fundamentally because the structures and, you know, grammar rules kind of really don't change all that much. Maybe you put the subject and the object before or after something, but that really helped. Mm-hmm. And I could compare and map vocabularies relatively easily.
All right. Thanks so much for the call to Radio Times. Ellen, what do you think?
Sure. I think, you know, there's actually documented evidence that the more languages you learn, the easier it is to learn languages. There's another factor, though, that I feel I need to raise. We study bilingualism in the sense that we investigate the cognitive and linguistic and brain processes of people who we believe are as comparable as they can be in all ways except for the number of languages they speak. So typically these are people who immigrated with a heritage language. They continued using it. They passed it on to their children. And it's easy enough in North America to find people who are quite comparable in experience and education and social class who are monolingual. When you look at multilingualism and polylingualism in particular, you're now looking at people who may have a talent for languages, because like everything, people differ in their ability to learn foreign languages.
Sure.
You might be looking at people who are strongly motivated to learn other languages and so on. So they're no longer necessarily comparable to monolinguals, because these are people who've already shown an exceptional talent or interest in something, and we can't say at that point that any differences are because they've learned the languages. It might be the other way around.
Ellen, we've got about 15 seconds, but Agnes asks, does your guest have any advice or tips on learning a difficult language like Irish more easily?
Again, I know nothing about how one goes about learning a language. So I would just encourage you to do it. The harder, the better it is for your brain.
All right, Ellen Bialystok, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ellen is a Walter Gordon York Research Chair of Lifespan Cognitive Development at York University. And just ahead, David Harrison, professor at Swarthmore, will talk about trying to preserve the world's endangered languages. That's coming up on Radio Times. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As we round out our show on the benefits of learning a foreign language, we're going to take an across-the-board look at the many thousands of different languages spoken across the world and the fact that many are in danger of dying out. A quick sample, Sicilian is listed as vulnerable, while Yiddish is being called definitely endangered by UNESCO. And there are lesser-known tongues like Kangdi and Ligurian also listed as definitely endangered. What is the value in trying to preserve languages? And if so, what do efforts to do so look like? David Harrison rounds out our conversation. He is professor of linguistics at Swarthmore College and also serves as director of research for the nonprofit Living Tongues Institute for Endangered Languages. Welcome, David.
Good morning, Marty. Thank you so much for devoting all this time to talking about linguistic diversity in the world. I was listening in on with your previous expert as well. It's fascinating.
Well, David, let's get to an approximation of you know, how many languages are spoken across the world.
The current number, Marty, is 7,120, and those are distinct languages. If we got into counting dialects as well, that number would go up. And one of the things that we've realized in recent years is that there are a number of hidden languages which are not included in that number, not because people don't know them, but because scientists haven't noticed them yet. And so we're going to be adding, as we explore the world's languages, we're going to be able to add to that number.
And what percentage are in danger of extinction?
At least 40%, maybe as high as 50%. You mentioned a couple of languages, Yiddish and others that are endangered. And languages are on a scale of endangerment, so you can have from slightly endangered to severely endangered to what's called moribund. A moribund language only has a few elderly individuals who speak it.
Why do languages die out?
I had to answer in one word, I would say globalization.
Yeah.
What happens as people move to urban centers and they enter national education systems, they are strongly discouraged from using heritage languages. And they're also made to feel that their native languages are not as worthy or worthwhile as the big national languages. And so it comes down to people's attitudes. If you have a negative attitude, if you internalize a negative attitude about a language, then as a child, you're going to abandon it and stop using it.
Let me reintroduce you. David Harrison is our guest for the remainder of the hour. He is a professor of linguistics at Swarthmore College, and I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. David, what does field research look like? How do you locate and even try to do a head count of a small band of people who might speak a particular tongue and say Papua New Guinea?
Yes. So thank you, Mary, for mentioning the South Pacific. I've been working recently in Vanuatu, which is the world's most diverse language hotspot. It is a small island nation, has a population of about 220,000 people. So, that's like one neighborhood in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
But among those 220,000 people, it has 110 languages. And so you can go island to island, village to village, and in some cases, each next village that you go to is a different language. And what I do as a field linguist, I go in and I ask people, hey, what language do you speak? What language is spoken in this place? And then I try to figure out who uses the language, how many people know the language. Are children speaking the language? I take the pulse of the language, as it were. Is it a vital language? Are children still speaking it, or are only the elders speaking it? And then I delve into what I call the knowledge base. So what is it that people know? What is the unique human knowledge and human genius that is encoded in this language? In the case of Vanuatu, where I've been working, it's very deep knowledge of botany, of plants, and how to make medicines from plants, of wind currents and ocean currents and navigation, highly specialized technologies and knowledge that are encoded in these languages.
And that you won't find elsewhere.
Absolutely. In fact, most of the information that humans possess and the wisdom and the knowledge isn't found anywhere except in people's minds. It's not, you can't Google it. It's not on Wikipedia. You can't look it up. It's not written down. Most of the world's languages don't use writing to record their knowledge. So it's all oral transmission.
See, well, David, some would say, it's natural for languages to die out as civilizations change and regroup. So why not let some of them go?
Uh-huh. Well, it does come down to a question of agency and human rights and cultural freedom. If you talk to people, people love their languages. People have a belief that their languages are uniquely beautiful and expressive, that they can emote, they can create poetry in their language. And usually when people give up a language or abandon a language, it isn't a free choice. It's some form of socioeconomic coercion. They're being told, or in extreme cases, it's children actually being punished for speaking their language, like in Wales. Welsh is a great success story of language revitalization. But in the 1950s and 60s in Wales, if you were a Welsh-speaking child and you got caught by your teacher speaking Welsh at school, you had to wear what's called the Welsh knot, which was a board that you hung around your neck, intended to shame and embarrass you for speaking Welsh. And the only way you could get rid of the knot, this board hanging, punishment board hanging around your neck, was you had to catch another child speaking Welsh, and then you could pass the knot onto that child.
Oh, that's awful.
So it was kind of a very strong, you can imagine how, shame is a very strong incentive to people to stop. And so as a result, Welsh approached the brink of extinction. There was a time in the 1960s and 70s where very few people comparatively were speaking it.
Well, before we go on, David, briefly, why was Welsh something that was so strongly discouraged among the young?
Well, English colonialism, part of Great Britain and the educational system. And then people said, oh, it's a backwards language. It's hard to pronounce. It's not suited for the modern world. All of the typical negative attitudes that you hear. In fact, Welsh is a wonderfully complex and poetic language. it's certainly more complex than English. I love the comment by your previous guest, Professor Ellen Bialystok. She said, the harder a language is, the better it is for your brain. It's like speaking Welsh is like weightlifting for the brain. It has these immensely long words.
How does English compare?
Well, English, partly because of its history and partly because of its status as a large global language that many people learn, it's somewhat simpler in its linguistic structures. Linguists used to say that all languages are equally complex, but we know now that that's not true. And if you pick up a grammar of, say, Navajo, you immediately realize that some languages can be more complex than others. It doesn't mean some languages are better than others or more expressive. It's just on the level of how they build words and sentences, some languages have more complexity. And this is an argument for, from a scientific view, why we want to preserve linguistic diversity in the world. We haven't yet documented more than perhaps 10 or 12% of the world's languages, so we don't even know how much diversity is possible. What kinds of complex structures can the human brain build?
Yeah, fascinating.
What types of poetry can we create?
Well, before we get to the calls, I did want to get to technology and how technology is helping to save at least some of these languages. Could you get into that for us, David Harrison?
Absolutely. I have a YouTube channel that's devoted. It's, if you look for Enduring Voices, the project I did with National Geographic, we have a YouTube channel devoted entirely to video recordings of endangered languages, people performing hip-hop in endangered languages. And this is, I mentioned globalization before as a negative factor, but it's also a positive effect. Small languages can leverage globalization. They can project themselves to a worldwide audience and get the word out about how beautiful and valuable their culture is. And I also create something called talking dictionaries. If you go to talkingdictionary.org, I've created over 100 talking dictionaries for small languages where you can hear thousands of words in the language and see the unique concepts. And for many of these languages, it's the first ever internet presence for these languages. So they have crossed the digital divide. They're using technology to sustain themselves. And so this is a wonderful global trend that we see in language revitalization is the technologizing of small languages.
Well, David Harrison, you know, youth, of course, are the future. I mean, how do you bring young people into the mix here? How do you interest them in learning and speaking the language of their forefathers in a globally connected world like ours?
You just make it cool to do so. And so I have lots of recordings of young speakers performing hip-hop, poetry, slam poetry, performances. Young people love technology. They love iPhone apps. And so the talking dictionaries are a way to do that. Social media is a great way to create a virtual language community. There are a number of Native American languages that are quite severely endangered, but they have created a virtual community on Facebook where people are talking about word meanings and how to and usages and how to use the language. And so this is part of the larger trend to apply technology to help save languages.
All right. Cletus in Bensalem is with us now on Radio Times. Welcome, Cletus. Do we have Cletus?
Mr. Harrison, I real quickly, I'd like to echo your story about the Welsh language. I'm of Irish descent, and I guess my late 40s, excuse me, I became fascinated with all things Irish, including the language. And I've been there four or five, six times maybe, and thank God all of the school children are required to learn Irish and English, at least in the Republic, maybe not the north part of Ireland, but in the same way that it's a beautiful and not easy language to learn. So thanks
for those
comments.
Right.
But I had a check. Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
Absolutely. And
anyway,
instilling a sense of pride and heritage in them is so important. This will help preserve the language.
Yeah. And Cletus, you had one other question?
Well, real quick, it might be off topic a little bit, but I wondered how does any of this topic tie in with sign language around the world and folks who can neither hear nor speak? And does that every other country have their own form of that? I just never thought of this in my life until today.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. All right, Cletus,
that is a great
question. We'll let you go. Thanks.
There is an Irish Sign Language that's completely different from English Sign Language. It's actually different from both British Sign Language and from American Sign Language, which are different from each other. So sign languages are unique. They're tied to a specific place, and they're not just versions of the local spoken language performed on the hands. They have their own unique grammar. So British Sign Language and American Sign Language are two completely different languages. They're not mutually comprehensible.
And David, are there efforts to preserve these languages, these sign languages around the
yes,
world?
And in fact, with the onset of cochlear implants and other technologies, there is some concern in deaf communities around the world that their languages may be endangered. We don't even know how many distinct sign languages are spoken in the world, and they're in the midst now of an effort to try to even answer that question. But we know there are at least hundreds of them. They spring up spontaneously wherever there's a deaf community, and most of them have not yet been recorded or documented.
Can a language be resurrected once it's gone?
There are some really interesting experiments to do just that. The Miami language, which is a Native American language spoken in the Midwest, Ohio, and those parts, had no speakers. And members of the community took legacy dictionaries and other forms of documentation. There were no sound recordings, but there were written records of the language. And there was a family linguist, Daryl Baldwin, who's a member of the Miami tribe and a speaker of the language, raised his children speaking only Miami as a kind of experiment. It's a difficult thing to do, to raise children speaking a language that no one else speaks. This was also done on the Isle of Man, which the Manx language had effectively disappeared. There were really no fluent speakers. And the community got together and they raised a generation of children speaking only Manx. And so now there are new Manx speakers. So it's difficult to do. It requires immense determination and pride in the language. But there are some interesting cases around the world where this has happened.
All right, let's go to Anna, who is in Philadelphia. Anna, welcome to Radio Times.
Hello, thank you.
Sure. What's your question?
As a citizen of the United States, knowing that English currently is the, whatever you call it, dominant language, but won't always be, how can I take advantage of the fact that I know I am a native English speaker? I'm interested in learning a bunch of other languages, but mainly preserving diversity of language. What can I be doing, as I live my life, as I get married, maybe have children, to help encourage the preservation of different languages from where I am here in Philadelphia?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, of course, as English speakers, we're all part of this giant global language that is really dominating. And one thing you can do is just to take an interest in, Philadelphia is a very multilingual city, and you and I both live in Philadelphia, and there's so many different language communities, bilingual people everywhere, interesting languages like Dzongkha, the language of Bhutan. There's a community in South Philadelphia that speaks that. So just taking an interest. When I visit public schools in Philadelphia, as I often do, I like to go around the classroom and ask the students what languages do their parents speak, and I'll get Albanian and Ukrainian and Hmong and Vietnamese and Cantonese just in a single classroom. And it's amazing because nobody has really ever ask these students what their heritage languages are or celebrated them. And so just sort of expressing a sense of respect and wonder at language diversity really encourages people, and it will help, as an English speaker, as you said, it will help to counterbalance the kind of globalizing pressures that are pushing languages into extinction.
Yeah, just curious, David, as you go about your work, your global work, have you picked up a number of languages yourself?
I've tried, and, as your previous guest was saying, it's great exercise for the brain to learn languages, but it also requires talent, and that talent decays with age. So as I get older, I always try to learn a few basic words and phrases in whatever language I may be studying, but I think I'm past the point where I could really become fluent in another language. So I would encourage your younger listeners and people who have children who are maybe interested in raising their children bilingually. The young years are the best time to expose people to languages.
Well, David Harrison, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.
Thank you, Mary.
He is professor of linguistics at Swarthmore College. And don't forget, check out our Facebook page, listen to our podcasts. You can find them all at whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.